Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and here's some advice for recent college graduates.
This isn't a way for a 25-year-old to save for retirement.
That's Greg McBride with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Greg says a certain investment just isn't for youngins. Listen once more.
This isn't a way for a 25-year-old to save for retirement.
So here's a quiz. What strategy should the youth market avoid? Is it A, annuities? Those high fees could eat into your bottom line. Or should 20-somethings not B, dump their savings into certificates of deposit? They boast high interest rates, but other investments earn more in the long run. Or maybe it's a bad idea to invest in C, a new PlayStation. Come on, kids, you can't retire on your high score in Grand Theft Auto. The answer's coming up on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
We talk a lot here about getting the best bang for your buck. Stocks, bonds, mutual funds, whatever you do, make your money work for you. Well, these days, the greenbacks themselves are earning their keep. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Hey, want a hot investing tip? Come closer. It's cash. That's right. Rising interest rates have become your friend if you're investing more money than you're borrowing, that is. CDs, money market funds, bonds, the whole fixed income side of the investing spectrum looks a lot more attractive than it has in a while. So Marketplace's Steve Tripoli is here to tell you how to cash in on investing's quiet side.
Frank Lowenthal is showing me some tools of an investment-picking arsenal in his cluttered home office.
You know, I have multiple computers, and I use multiple websites.
He's a retired suburban Boston engineer who avidly manages his portfolio. Lowenthal says his computers and websites have been dictating big changes lately in his family's holdings.
If you go back a couple of years, I would say that we were probably 90% in stock.
Not anymore. Not by a long shot. Lowenthal's 80% in cash these days, mostly short-term certificates of deposit from local banks. He just doesn't like the stock market right now, but at 62, he also needs some of that money soon.
We have a son in college, and he's going to go to grad school, so some of it will be used for that. I'm retired, so we may draw on some of that for our income.
Most financial planners would frown on quickly shifting so much money from any asset class, like stocks, to another like cash. And few planners would recommend an 80% cash portfolio like Lowenthal's for most folks. But in today's low inflation, rising interest rate environment, financial planner Deborah Neiman says there's a lot to like about fixed income assets like cash and bonds, including their set payoff.
Yields have increased, so now you could find one-year CDs. I think they're averaging about 4.88% nationally, and that's attractive. You know, for no risk, to get almost 5%, that's a nice option.
You can even find safe one-year CDs paying 5.5% if you shop some nationwide financial websites like Bankrate.com. So should you be moving some money into cash or bonds? Deborah Neiman says investors should run down a list of standard questions first.
And by that, I mean what their goals and objectives and needs are and their risk tolerance and time horizon.
Neiman says cash and short-term bonds are good for people drawing income from their investments. They also work for anyone needing the money soon and those going through sudden life changes like a layoff. And if you haven't rebalanced your portfolio lately, that's another fixed income opening. You may have more stocks than you want in there because stocks have done so well lately. They may have outgrown the balance you want between stocks and the fixed income side. So now's the time to move some winnings over. But don't go overboard.
This isn't a way for a 25-year-old to save for retirement.
Bankrate.com's Greg McBride says chasing safer but lower-yielding fixed income investments isn't so safe for those with long time horizons.
The risk is that inflation will devour the bulk of their returns and leave them with very little in the way of growth in their nest egg.
Even our investor Frank Lowenthal, who's 80% in certificates of deposit now, is a long-term investor despite being retired. That's because he's relatively young and hopes to pass his portfolio on to his son eventually. Lowenthal knows that money has to go back into stocks sooner or later. But for now, he's comfortable with being so heavily into cash and out of the market.
The danger is that the market may go up and you're out of it, but you're getting a yield with your money. So it's the spread between what the market might do and what you're getting in the bank or in your other fixed income.
So let's close with a couple of strategy tips. If you're shopping the internet for CDs, make sure any out-of-state bank or credit union is federally insured. That means you'll get your money back if something happens. And remember that most money market or bond mutual funds are not federally insured. And if a way above average interest rate catches your eye, beware. There's usually some hidden risk in that higher rate. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
We just heard how helpful interest rates can be for an investor, but a lot of us only invest with one tool, our 401k retirement plan. After Congress passed the Pension Protection Act last year, 401ks were supposed to be easier to get into. It allowed companies to automatically enroll their employees. But regulators still have to decide what plans work best. Conservative, stable value plans backed by insurance companies, or riskier life cycle or target date funds. That's a mixture of stocks and bonds that change over time, backed by mutual funds. Charles Ruffel is with the firm PlanSponsor.com. Charles, first, what does this mean for employers?
What employers have to do, particularly if they adopt automatic enrollment, is essentially create a default investment. And the issue at stake is what that default investment is and how it's defined. That's what the battle is at the moment.
So are the life cycle funds, the target date funds, is that becoming the general default for employers?
Historically, defaults in this space have been looked at differently. They've been looked at through the eyes of capital preservation. The idea was if you defaulted somebody into an investment option, you should make sure you don't lose the money. What matters now going forward is that people are going to be defaulted essentially for life into these vehicles. So the idea of a capital preservation product is really outdated. What the Department of Labor has already essentially given a green light to is plan sponsors defaulting people into asset allocated funds like target date funds or effectively vehicles that can provide an investment return.
Let's talk about how and why this matters for the employee. If you are with an employer who's decided to automatically opt you into a retirement plan, as allowed now by the Pension Act, why should you care about this debate?
It matters because for the first time, really, we have the beginnings of a framework that really could allow the 401k plan as it now exists, essentially, to really provide this elusive concept of retirement with dignity. If that's going to happen, people who are automatically defaulted into these products have to have some confidence that they're the right products and that they're going to grow. People are going to be in these products in many cases as we move forward from the moment they start their working career to the moment they retire, and in some cases beyond, which essentially means if they're not put into the right vehicles, if they're not defaulted into the right vehicles, they have no chance of accumulating the assets that they need to retire. And considering really we're moving into an era where all that matters in terms of most Americans' ability to retire with dignity is what's in their 401k plan, this is central obviously to individuals, but it's a huge societal issue. We have to get it right. In terms of the architecture that's been set up both by the Pension Protection Act and what the Department of Labor is now doing, we're looking at an architecture that can actually work. And the question is just to make it work in an optimal way.
So what happens next with the Department of Labor?
Well, it's up in the air as to whether the Department of Labor greenlights stable value funds as a default option. If they do greenlight it, if they allow it to happen, then it has real significance in that people who've historically been defaulted into stable value funds will likely at least be in a position to stay in them, and there won't have to be sort of massive changes in terms of historic defaults.
Mm-hmm.
But I think going forward, it's pretty irrelevant in a way. The marketplace as a whole has come to understand that capital preservation vehicles like stable value funds are not the right options for 401k plans. I mean, there are instances where people can choose to opt into those products. Perhaps they have savings elsewhere and they just want stability. But for most working Americans, that's absolutely not the case. So to some extent, this battle has been fought and won. And really, the stable value industry is really fighting over yesterday's war, but it's still one that maybe needs to be fought.
All right. Charles Ruffel is the CEO of PlanSponsor.com. Thanks so much for coming in.
That's a pleasure.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Picture it with me now. It's early in the morning, and overnight, the price of gas shot up to $4 a gallon. You're fueling the house on wheels that you call your car. The pump stops, so you leave, but you notice your tank's half empty. Well, we've got two possible answers. You've got a tapeworm in your tank, or you went over a little-known limit that many gas stations impose at the behest of credit card companies. Yeva Augstums is a business reporter with the Associated Press. Yeva, what's going on here?
Before gas prices actually started rising, you know, people would just swipe their credit card, get a full tank of gas, and drive off. But recently, with gas prices being as high as they have been and continuing to increase, some consumers out there have swiped their card and then realized, wait a minute, the pump is shutting off, sometimes at $50, sometimes at $75. I started looking into what was going on and came to be that it's actually a preventative measure from the credit card companies to stop fraud at the gas pump.
What do you mean by fraud at the gas pump? How does that happen?
Well, sometimes, let's say if your credit card is stolen, someone can go ahead and just take that credit card and decide, oh, I'm going to go, you know, let's rake up some charges and maybe I'll get a tank of gas with it. And it's a policy actually that's been around for years between credit cards or the issuer and merchants, in this case, you know, gas stations. And what it is, it's actually a limit that the credit card companies will put on what they call a cardholder activated terminal, such as a gas pump, and that limits have just been, you know, preset.
And that's not something that the consumer himself or herself is aware of.
No, in normal cases, no. I mean, some consumers have gone into the gas stations and have asked, you know, whoa, what's going on? How come my pump is, you know, shutting off at $50? And the gas stations have been saying, oh, it's your bank or it's the credit card company. It's not a policy we have. And in essence, they're correct. It's not a policy that they have, but it's up to the gas station if they wanted to go ahead and abide by that rule. Most will.
So is there anything you can do as a consumer if you are at the gas station trying to fill up and you can't use your credit card? I mean, can you like split it between two credit cards or something?
You can in some cases go ahead and split it. But in most cases, you still can pay for a full tank of gas if you go in and pay for it inside the store. So, it's the convenience factor. Those that want to go ahead and, you know, pay at the pump, just swipe the card, get the gas, and go. But if you want to, you know, go inside, wait in line, you can, you know, fill up with $56.36 and let's say not be cut off at $50.
All right. Yeva Augstums is a business writer with the Associated Press. Thanks so much for sussing this out and sharing it with all of us.
Thank you.
Is a closed-end mutual fund friend or foe? Chris opens the discussion in the mailbag. And for this artist, the beach is one big canvas.
It's very fragile. It's kind of like life. It's a metaphor for life.
Dude, a day in the work life of a sand sculptor. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. July 4th's just around the corner. Time for barbecues, big bangs, and the beach. Bring a good book and sunscreen, and if you're in the mood to get creative, perhaps try your hand at a sandcastle. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet a guy who's made a career out of that pastime. We caught up with him at Riviera Beach, Massachusetts.
My name's Sean Fitzpatrick. a master sand sculptor and organizer of the largest master sand sculpting competition in New England. Sand sculpting started kind of by accident. I started about 15 years ago, actually in snow, when my daughter, who was 3 years old at the time, asked me to go outside and build a snowman. One catch, though. She said, "Dad, it has to look like Santa Claus." I said, okay, so I went out there and spent several hours out in the snow and came back in, very proud of myself. It looked just like Santa Claus. So I seemed to have a natural knack at sculpting. When I first thought about doing this as a business, my wife and my friends were very skeptical, saying, who was I going to sell my work to? And, you know, how was I going to pay for health insurance? And, yeah, there was a lot of buzz going on, but I did it very slowly, built the business up over several years, and now the questions are all gone. There's no question anymore. Our client list ranges from individual families wanting sculpting lessons for their kids' birthday parties, all the way up to major networks wanting a special sculpture done for a TV show.
I've done a 15-foot tall replica of Hogwarts Castle. I've done sculptures of Harry Potter, Superman. And, of course, this being Boston Red Sox Nation, I've done sculptures of Jason Veritek, catcher of the Boston Red Sox.
I can get anywhere from $1,500 for a small sandcastle on a tabletop. And then if we brought in 200 tons of sand to a large football field area and sculpted a life-size replica of the Coors Light train, that could be upwards of $50,000, $60,000. And then when the fall rolls around, I switch over to pumpkins. And then I also do ice sculpting in the winter and snow sculpting. So I'm pretty busy year-round. I can make anywhere from $50,000 to $150,000 a year on a good year. Well, it's funny, with this business, I don't get much vacation time, so we end up taking long weekends. But what usually happens is we end up at the beach, sometimes in Gloucester, sometimes up in York, Maine. But I'll always end up spending 8 or 10 hours on the beach building sand sculptures. And that's just what I love to do. Whether I'm working or playing, it just seems natural to me. So that's my vacation time. One thing that really attracted me to sand sculpting versus sculpting stone or wood was that the impermanence of it is a beautiful thing. It's very fragile. It's kind of like life. It's a metaphor for life. And people that see it get to enjoy it for the moment. It's like a gift. So the people that do get to see it and enjoy it, they're blessed by it.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at nasdfoundation.org.
A not-so-clever disguise brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, Money Card. Money Card is a new venture from retail giant Walmart. It's a prepaid debit card that looks and acts just like regular debit cards. Cardholders can electronically deposit paychecks, make purchases, and withdraw cash using any ATM. Does that mean Walmart's becoming Walbank? Well, last year, Walmart tried to obtain a banking license, and the Fed turned them down. But financial products like the Money Card don't require a banking license.
Can I get a price check on loopholes?
Got a box full of letters. Thinking my life to read.
Hi, I'm Tess Viglund, and here to help all of us figure out your unique financial questions is our own financial expert, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm well. You ready for some questions?
Yes.
All right. But before we get to answering them, We'll ask everyone to take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there. Or you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. All right, let's go to the phones. Jeff is on the line from Santa Maria, California. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm just a self-employed massage therapist in Santa Maria. Been in the oil business for 30 years, but retired from that and mess around a little bit with stocks and mutual fund, but not in a big way.
Well, I understand you have a question about something you saw on TV.
Yeah, I was watching. I wake up early every day and watch Squawk Box, and one day the CEO of Hirschfeld Caribbean Fund was on, and he expressed the intentions of that fund to someday invest in a big way into Cuba, and that would follow the passing of Fidel Castro, obviously.
And the assumption there is that that economy is going to open up to outside investment at some point.
Yeah, that's what I got. And so I put a little bit of money in it, and then I've just been holding on to it for about 3 years now. And I read on the internet how it's a closed-in fund. And I wonder if it could be that that's not such a great investment. That was my question.
Well, let's talk a little bit then about what a closed-end mutual fund is, and that's closed-end, E-N-D.
Okay. So let's start with the typical mutual fund that most of us participate in at work, say through a 403B or 401K or, you know, the ones that are always talked about. You buy and sell those securities all the time. So you own, Fidelity X, and you decide to redeem your shares. And so they give you your money, and then other people decide, hey, I want to be in here. And so they buy some shares, right? And it's just going back and forth all the time. A closed-end fund is sold like a publicly traded stock. It issues shares, a fixed number of shares, to the public, and it's sold on a stock exchange. And then it owns securities within this company, like, for example, the Cuba fund. I mean, the stock ticker symbol is Cuba. It owns a number of companies that do business in the Caribbean, and obviously some speculation that may go into the may participate or benefit from the decline of communism in Cuba.
So is this something that's worthwhile investing in, a closed-end fund?
There are people who love closed-end funds. You can do a lot of research. A lot of it is a little bit of a game because it's kind of an area where people who want to do a little extra work and want to play around with. But I don't necessarily recommend it for people, but I don't say stay away from it. But just recognize it does take more work than buying your ordinary, everyday, plain vanilla mutual fund.
All right. There you go.
Well, thank you.
Does that help you?
Well, not as much as Castro dying would help me, but yeah.
Okay, then.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call. All right, let's reach into the email bag. And Sarah wrote in from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and she's a special ed teacher making about $35,000 a year. Recently, she received a large workers' comp claim, but the injuries probably are not going to affect her ability to work in the future. Her financial advisor has advised her to pay off student loan debt, about $40,000 worth, but she's heard that some programs offer loan forgiveness for special ed teachers. And before she pays anything off, she wants to know if that's true, and if so, how does she find out more information on it?
Well, it is true. There is a teacher loan forgiveness program, and within that category, teaching special ed. Now, there's all kinds. I know you're going to be surprised on this test. You know, there's all kinds of restrictions and, you know, various tests that you have to pass.
Course.
But it's definitely, definitely worth looking into. And if you go to studentaid.ed.gov, that's the section of the Department of Education's website that lays out about the teacher loan forgiveness program. And depending on, it can be up to, $17,500. It's a good chunk of change. And by the way, just as a broader point, for people who are doing certain things in volunteer work, military, teaching, certain types of legal and medical studies. You know, there are a number of loan forgiveness programs, and it is worth investigating them, particularly if you're dealing with at-risk populations, disabled populations. It's clearly an area to look into. And for her, I definitely would say go to the Department of Education website and look at whether or not you qualify for this teacher loan forgiveness program.
All right. Sounds like a plan, Sarah. If you've got a financial situation you can't seem to get a straight answer for, give us a chance. We might be able to figure out what's the real solution. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. All right. Let's go to caller number two. Dan is on the line from Wayland, Massachusetts. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm 15, and I've saved up some money over the past few years. Around $750. I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions on what I should invest in.
Chris, this is terrific. A 15-year-old with $750 saved up. Bravo.
I'll say.
How did you get the money?
I don't know. I just haven't really spent that much of it. I get an allowance and then Christmas money and birthday money and stuff.
Well done. All right, so we've got $750 with which to invest. Chris, what's your recommendation?
Well, Dan, quick question. Do you have any, you know, passions, interests, things that you do that, you know, maybe you might want to think about? This is an area to invest in?
Well, I like lacrosse and rowing crew.
Great. My 15-year-old does rowing.
Yeah.
He loves it. Just started here. I have a couple thoughts. If we were, you know, talking long term and you wanted to build a portfolio over time and even past, you know, college, I'd be saying, look, let's go and invest in a broad-based stock mutual fund. But I want to have a little more fun seeing what's going on in the market. You know, I might then want to do a little research in Nike, some sporting goods stores that have been doing well. You could sort of go into the sporting area. I'm not aware of any skulls that are publicly traded.
Yeah, that would be S-C-U-L-L, not S-K-U-L-L.
Exactly. Yes, we're talking about the sport of rowing.
Okay.
So, because one thing that's fun for a young person in terms of investing is, you know, things that they're interested in, things that they want to do. To invest in that area just adds, and they have an interest, and it sort of makes it fun, and you learn about the markets. You're using this money to learn about the markets and hopefully to make some money. If the goal is to make money over a longer period of time, then I'm going to be very blunt. You're not going to do what I want to suggest in terms of looking into sporting goods stores or some international makers of ski equipment or that type of thing. You'll go into a broad-based equity mutual fund, let it compound over time, and you'll be richer than most of your peers when you're 45, 50 years old. There's no question about that.
And Dan, what Chris means by an equity-based mutual fund is basically just a very basic stock fund. Have you heard of the S&P 500?
Yeah.
So it's an index fund that basically mirrors how the S&P 500 does on the stock market from day to day.
Okay.
And what you could do is go to indexfunds.com, and you can learn a lot of information about index funds, and, you know, at your own speed and your own time.
So, Dan, have you finished up school for the year yet?
No. Tomorrow's my last final.
What's the subject?
Biology.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I can't help you with that one. Can you, Chris?
Not anymore. I'm way past that one.
Dan, you are on your own. What are you doing this summer?
I'm actually going on a camp to Hawaii.
Terrific. Well, again, congratulations on being an early saver. We always like to hear that on this show, and you're a role model for everyone your age and beyond.
Okay.
All right, take care.
Yeah, you too.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Trump, Gates, Buffett, if you want your kids to grow up to be one of them, well, maybe Gates or Buffett. Sometimes all it takes is getting them interested in financial education from a young age. Who knows? Give us a call. We'll help you start your children on the road to financial freedom, starting at $750. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit our website, marketplace.org. Click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right. Email number two, Chris, comes from Mike in Santa Rosa Beach, Florida. And he has a custodial account for his 10-year-old daughter who has a learning disability called apraxia. Have you heard about this?
No.
Yeah, apparently not much is known about this condition or kind of what they can expect of her academic future because of this disability. But he still wants to plan for the possibility that she will be able on some level to get herself into higher education. So given this unique situation, Mike's question is, does it make more sense to open a 529 plan or continue to fund her custodial account? So let's start first of all with an explanation of what is a custodial account.
Well, a custodial account is she's 10 years old. So a parent sets a custodial account and therefore directs the investments. But when, depending on the state, but when the daughter is of age, which is usually 18, but can be 18 to 21, it's her money.
Okay.
The 529 plan, we talk about those a lot. One thing I want to clear up with the 529 plan, we all have this image that a 529 plan goes toward college. It's a good reason why we think about that. But it can also go to community college. It can go to a trade school.
So it doesn't matter what kind of education you have.
No, it's some form of higher education. And a trade school is higher education. Community college, clearly higher education.
Mm-hmm.
So, your daughter, you can make some judgments. The 529 plan, from a financial point of view, makes more sense unless you strongly think that, we're not going to be doing some form of higher education, including trade school or community college. If that's the case, you want to keep funding a custodial account when all the money's hers, when she's 18 or 21, depending on the state, I'd have some serious questions about that. I'd be saving the money in my own name.
Why?
By keeping the money in your own name, you have some flexibility. So my first choice would be making a judgment. I think 529 makes sense. Keep the money in your own name, and then the third would be the custodial account.
If Mike decides to go ahead and open up a 529 plan, what happens with that money if his daughter doesn't end up going to school after high school?
That is the risk. If it doesn't go on to higher education at all, I mean, you can always withdraw the money and pay a penalty.
Okay.
And then pay the taxes. You could transfer it to somebody else, which is another option.
But once the money goes into a 529 plan, it has to go toward education, or you pay a tax penalty.
That's right. I mean, that's the deal. It does go toward education, so I understand his hesitation. So that may lean toward, the most sensible thing to do is put in some long-term investments in your own name, keep the taxes down, keep the maximum flexibility, because you really don't know what's going to happen over the next 10 years in terms of whether or not education is going to be the right direction for your daughter, at least higher education.
All right. Hope that helps, Mike. And unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's hour, but leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or visit our contact page on our website. We're at marketplace.org. Chris, thanks so much for the terrific education you give us every week.
Thanks, Tess.
Debt collectors want your money, and they have a new approach to getting it.
What we do is we really bring some intelligence to it so that they are collecting on the right account at the right time.
And for college graduates, it's time to get real. We have advice from last year's class on managing your money. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tessa Veglund. We Americans love our credit cards, and debt collection agencies love that we love them. Their business jumped 11-fold in just over a decade, from $6 billion worth of collections in 1993 to $66 billion in 2005. But the industry isn't satisfied with that success. It's been frustrated by the folks it can't seem to track down. But in our electronic age, we're providing some new solutions. Ashley Milne-Dyte reports.
Sonia is a young mother from Staten Island, New York. She says she's always carried some credit card debt, but she used to have an excellent credit score. Then she and her husband split up. Their little daughter had recently been diagnosed with autism. Sitting in a cafe near her daughter's school, Sonia says she couldn't keep her traffic department job and care for her daughter, so she went on welfare. A lot of that care costs money. Her ex-husband was paying a few hundred dollars a month in child support.
That's all he could afford at that time. So I started charging the things that she needed for her autism, like pressure vests, A lot of people with autistic kids know what I'm talking about. It's very expensive, very, very expensive stuff.
Before long, she'd racked up $25,000 in credit card debt. She signed up with a debt consolidation firm that said it would help her pay back what she owed. But the company turned out to be a scam. They cleaned out her bank account. Then collectors began to call and make their position clear.
That just because I'm on welfare doesn't mean that, you know, I still have to pay this debt. And I explained, she goes, I understand, but we need our money.
Third-party collectors in particular are relentless in following that money. After all, they bought the debt on the cheap from the original creditor and intend to profit by reaping back the original amount. Say you owe $1,000 on a Citibank credit card. Citibank will eventually decide to write off that debt. A third-party collector will buy it from Citibank, sometimes for pennies on the dollar. And now there's a new electronic service called Collection Triggers that could make it easier for collectors to get their money. It's being marketed by credit bureau Experian. Michael McAuliffe is with the Family Credit Counseling Service. He says in the old days, debt collectors would periodically pull debtors' credit reports.
Now what happens is they can actually log their clients' names with Experian, who will then notify them within 24 hours if some good things happen for that consumer, such as making payments on an old bill, bringing an account current, opening a new line of credit.
As soon as the collector receives the happy news, they can pick up the phone. Joe Rideout of the group Consumer Action isn't impressed.
One effect of this is likely to be that when someone finally is getting back on their feet financially and is right about to get off their debt treadmill, there will be a deluge of collection calls because their ability to pay supposedly has improved, even if that means nothing more than they have open space on a credit card.
He says Experian's being irresponsible, almost encouraging people to stay in debt. But Experian's Dan Buell doesn't see it that way.
The thing to remember is that this is a valid debt that was incurred. And oftentimes, particularly in a post-judgment situation, this was a debt that was vetted with an objective third party, being the court.
Still, consumer advocates Joe Rideout and Michael McAuliffe fear an instant service like this could encourage some debt collectors' unethical business practices. Both men say they hear regularly from consumers who've been hassled by collectors who are breaking the law by calling at all hours or threatening them with jail if they don't pay. McAuliffe used to work in the collections department of a bank.
When I did it, I had a partner, and he was a tough guy, and I was a nice guy, and I would tell him that I'm just doing my job. I need to get this bill taken care of. If I'm not able to collect on it, I'm going to have to hand it off to someone else, and you're not going to want to deal with him.
That was all above board, he says. Things can get a lot uglier. But Dan Buell of Experian says Collection Triggers technology aims to cut down on that ugliness. He says any interaction between a stressed-out debtor
and a collector whose responsibility to the businesses and the shareholders is to collect that debt, that can be a potentially volatile interaction. So what we do is we really bring some intelligence to it so that they are collecting on the right account at the right time.
There's one thing both sides agree on. The debt collection industry is growing in part because there's a lot more for collectors to do these days. Even the smallest infraction, like a late library book, can land on the collector's books and lower your credit score. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
All right, if you've ever been targeted by a debt collector, we'd like to hear your story. Visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on Contact.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
There's no experience quite like those first few months after college. If all goes well, you've got a paycheck. For me, that meant $17,000 a year. And you've got to figure out how that money's going to feed, house, and clothe you, not to mention pay for the parties in your new apartment. We all came up with our own ways of stretching a dollar. I practically lived on Triscuits topped with tuna and American cheese and toasted under the broiler. But for more recent and perhaps tastier advice on making the transition into the real world, we've turned to those who've just done it. So class of 07, we present to you personal finance advice from the class of 06.
My name is Katie Abendanza.
I went to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst.
My name is Jorge Alex Del Pinal. I graduated from American University.
My name is Sarah LaDuke. I attended SUNY Albany in the capital of New York State. I have a lot more money now than I had when I was in college only working on breaks, but I also have a lot more day-to-day expenses. I'm living on my own and feeding myself and never staying with my parents and not still staying in the dorm. Like the reality of having to pay rent every month. I mean, it's real. It's very real.
There was a lot of unexpected expenses with moving. You know, the first last security deposit, that adds up to close to $3,000 in addition to buying work clothes so you aren't wearing ripped jeans every day. And definitely the moving van was extremely expensive.
When you're looking for somewhere to live, just try to find a place that has places you're going to go nearby, a grocery store nearby, you know, if possible, near your work. That's great if you can do that because you just save a ton of money on gas.
I eat breakfast at home every morning so as not to stop somewhere and grab a bagel because that can add up. And then I usually bring a sandwich or at least a yogurt for lunch and try to make dinner at home too, but I end up eating out a bit more than I probably should.
You can go out. There are lots of half-price burger nights, which we definitely hit up, or happy hours. I always like to have people over to our house. There's a back porch, so you can have barbecues, and it's definitely cheaper than hitting the town 5 nights a week.
If you're going out, drink stuff before because it's cheaper than later, and just buy like a couple drinks when you're there.
I got a credit card. My parents graciously let me have one for emergencies and then abused it because I emergency think that I need, you know, something shiny and new. The hardest thing is trying to find the balance between stuff that you do need to do or really want to do in a way that you'd at least in some minor way regret it if you didn't get to do it. Social events, concerts or plays or road trips with your friends. But in your like happiness budget, you have to take a step back and not always do it, but do it when it's something really important.
My grandmother loves to sit me down and talk about finances. She always tells me that I should pay myself first. That means that you put money in your savings account before you think that you can spend it.
Another way to save money, and you know, it'll just be helpful to yourself, is just do something creative. If you do art, if you write, not that you have to make something of that, but you could, and that's a great way to spend time.
So I didn't have health insurance for about a year, which was pretty scary. But I had to end up going to the doctors without insurance, and I racked up a bill that was over $600. When it came in the mail, I decided that it just was unreasonable for me to be able to pay this. So I called up the accounting department at the hospital, and they decided to take 60% off the bill as long as I agreed to pay the rest. So I saved over $400 just on one phone call.
I think, for me personally, it's exciting to see that I am doing it. People, if you look around, and it's surprising to think almost everybody, hopefully, almost everybody you pass on the street is making it on a day-to-day basis. And to be one of the people of the world contributing to making it, it feels all right.
Brendan Noonan produced that story for us.
Next week, Apple's iPhone hits retail shelves, and the heavens shall open, and a new dawn of peace and prosperity shall set the world aglow. Or that's what you'd expect given the hype around this thing. But let's put it all in perspective. No matter how awesome the iPhone turns out to be, there will still be one essentially lame thing about cell phones: the multi-year contracts you have to sign to get a calling plan. So here's something worth hyping. You can get out of those contracts. Here to tell us how is Janine Kenny of Consumers Union. Janine, I'm guessing this is not easy.
Getting out isn't tough. Getting out without paying a steep fine is very difficult. Consumers are stuck with, in some cases, penalties of up to $240 per phone when they cancel their contract. And if you have a family plan with four lines, you could be looking at a penalty of up to $800 or more in some cases. So it's a steep cost.
Are there ways to get out without having to pay those fees?
There are a few ways. The first and the most obvious is for consumers to use the grace period. When you sign up for a cell phone contract, most carriers will give you a grace period. A lot of times it's only a couple of weeks. Sometimes it's 30 days. Often it's that grace period expires before you get your first bill. The other thing that consumers can do, and this is a little trickier, is in the fine print of your contract, you'll notice that the carrier reserves the right to change the terms of the contract at any point in time. And if they make what's called a material change that adversely impacts you, you'll have the right to get out, usually within 30 days of that change in the contract. But you have to watch for it, and they're going to give you notice on your bill.
Probably in teeny tiny print that you can't read.
That's right. So you really have to be careful. Now, if you're really desperate, if you look in your contract, almost every carrier has a clause that says if you roam more than half the time you use your phone, they reserve the right to cancel your contract without a penalty. So if you're desperate...
Just go drive around in the middle of nowhere, right?
That's right. Well, the carriers lose because most carriers offer unlimited roaming now. If you roam the majority of the time, they start losing money. So I'm not necessarily recommending that people do that, but I certainly know that is one way out where you won't pay a penalty.
All right. Well, that's certainly a creative way to go. At any other way to get out of these, what are usually two-year contracts?
Yeah, there are some new services that have developed. One's called Cell Trade. One's called Cell Swapper. And it's an online service that will help you try to find someone who wants a contract and who will be willing to take over your contract.
And you can just transfer it like that?
You have to get your carrier to cooperate, and usually they will. They may not make it easy, and it's not a sure thing, but anecdotally, some consumers have found that to be a successful strategy.
All right. Janine Kenny is a policy analyst for Consumers Union, and she's been telling us how to hang up on our cell phone providers. Thanks for the help.
Thank you, Tess.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
Decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor Chris Farrell to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what is the straight story. And Chris, hey man, what's going on?
Don't you always ask that?
I do always ask that, but this time I'm asking about drugs. You know, over the last couple of years on Marketplace, it seems like we're always reporting on another drug safety scandal. And the current controversy, of course, is surrounding the safety of a diabetes drug called Avandia.
The question is, where is the Food and Drug Administration? I mean, they are supposed to be our drug safety watchdog, right?
Right. But I saw that there was a Harris poll, a Wall Street Journal Harris poll, that showed that almost half of Americans believe that the FDA does a fair to poor job.
That seems like a bad report card for a federal agency.
I'd have to agree.
You know, the FDA can't get rid of this tension between the need for speed in approving drugs and the necessity of caution to make sure they're safe. I mean, it's in the nature of the beast. That said, you know, thanks to a bargain that was struck back in 1992, the FDA is far too dependent on industry money, and not enough funds are going toward addressing some really glaring problems, the ones that you're reporting on in Marketplace, such as monitoring drug safety long after a pharmaceutical is approved for sale. Here's a straight story. Congress, better funding of the FDA would help sever cozy ties between the beleaguered agency and drug makers.
Let's talk a little bit more about this bargain that you talked about back in 1992. What was that and how did that come about?
The agency has been chronically underfunded. And at that time, it was taking 2 years or more to approve a drug. A lot of AIDS activists were rightly upset about this because they were just dragging their heels in terms of approving drugs. So a deal was struck. And at the time, it made a lot of sense. Industry would put up money, help funding for drug review. And by putting up some money, then they'd hire more people and they could be a lot quicker in coming out with the drug reviews. And that was fine. The problem is, like all bargains, the devil is in the details.
You would call that automatically a conflict of interest, wouldn't you?
Yes, you would. And over time, what's happened is that, yes, there has been a speed up in drug reviews, but there hasn't been money going toward things like monitoring drug safety over time.
Let's talk a little bit about what, if any, role the consumer can play in all this. Because frankly, we get a prescription from the doctor. People, you know, they want these drugs to extend their lives and make their lives better.
That's right.
But what can we do in terms of solving this FDA problem?
My automatic reaction to a lot of things is go online, right? If you go online, it's not very helpful because there's so much passion that has been unleashed between the defenders of the FDA and the people who are opposed to the FDA, the people who like the drug companies and the people who despise the drug companies. So if you really want to get confused, Tess, go online. You're not going to get good information there. So then I was reading this commentary by David Carr. He writes it's called Media Equation for the New York Times.
Right.
And he was dealing with this issue. And, you know, in the end, I think he came up with the right solution. Have a serious conversation with your doctor, ask a lot of questions, and in the end, that's who you're going to have to rely on, because you and I, as a consumer, cannot make a lot of these judgments about drug safety and drug risk. You don't want to take your drug information from the television advertisements.
Because that really just puts pressure then on the doctor to give you the drug that you say, oh, I've seen it on TV and it's got to work for me.
Exactly. And when you talk to doctors, a lot of them, it drives them crazy.
Right. All right. The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks as always for being our prescription for clarity.
Oh, I like that. And thanks a lot.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, personal data be gone. If only that wish could be as easy as a computer command.
Unfortunately, the pretty inefficient way that I've gone about it so far is I just haven't thrown any computers away. I've got them in a pile in my closet.
Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes and Nancy Fargali, with Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. This week's special thanks to Robbie Carman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working with Habitat for Humanity to build over 350 homes this year with families in need. On the web at thriventbuilds.com.
American Public Media.